And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and it's great to have Kevin Wilson back on the program today. His short story collection, Tunneling to the Center of the Earth, won an Alex Award and the Shirley Jackson Award. His first novel, The Family Fang, was turned into a major motion picture by Jason Bateman. But today we'll be talking about his recently published second novel, Perfect Little World. Perfect Little World is what child development scientist Dr. Preston Grind wants to make with his Infinite Family project. What's the driving concept behind the project, Kevin?
What's the driving concept? It's this idea that if you can raise children collectively in a kind of singular space where everyone works together, the children will be phenomenal. It's this idea that if you put all of the best of science and psychology into the raising of children, they'll automatically be perfect.
But he doesn't think it's like a communal living, like a hippie commune or a kibbutz or anything like
that. He's big on making it clear that it's not a commune. It's an experiment of sorts. It's a group of people working towards a common scientific goal. But it sounds a lot like a commune.
So how is it different from like a kibbutz?
I don't know that there is much of one other than there is this kind of conceit at the heart of it, which is that the children are raised communally so that they don't even know who their true biological parents are. So the idea is that a child has not two parents, but 10 parents, 20 parents. So it's this idea that if you raise everyone as if they are your flesh and blood, they will respond to you as such.
The focus is on the children. The adults are allowed to have their own lives outside of raising the children.
Exactly, right. So the adults can go off to their jobs, can do all their work. There are a team of people, researchers working with the children, but everyone comes back together kind of at the end of the day.
Preston is a second-generation child development researcher.
Yes.
And his parents studied in the field. He was their main test subject.
Yes. Yeah, he's the product of what the Grind doctors came up with called the constant friction method, which is this idea that children are coddled too much in their youth and that they need to be prepared for the harsh realities of the world so that you create constantly situations where the children are put, if not in harm's way, in artificial adversity to teach them how to respond.
That makes the name very appropriate, Grind and Friction.
Yeah, I'm glad you... Yeah, it's true. I always just... Every time I think of Dr. Grind, I imagine him silently grinding his teeth against the kind of betrayals of the world.
And I thought with Preston, take off the N, it's presto, and it's bam, you're in a new... hey, hot shot.
That's very nice. That's very good. Yeah, it all came out of... I knew that his son was going to be called Jody Grind, which was a band out of Atlanta. I was like, okay, there'll be a boy named Jody Grind. And then I thought, oh, Grind, that's a good name. That will work for my purposes.
Now, it seems like living in an environment where you can't count on anything is just going to induce so much anxiety into him, it's untenable.
Right, yeah. It's this idea that if you are raised with this artificial expectation of constant friction, then you'll see it everywhere. You can never let your guard down, right? You can never kind of relax. Even when you're surrounded by people that love you, you're still afraid that something's going to happen. It seems like a terrible method. It seems like a method that would come out of the 70s or 80s.
Now, both of your books have featured kind of strange parenting choices. I guess there would be quite a bit of anxiety in the way you're raising your kids.
Yeah, I mean, I write about families because I have a family and it's pretty much all I think about is I have two young children. And if you're a parent, there are 100 different people telling you 100 different ways that you should be raising your child. And all of them say, if you don't do it this way, the kids will be ruined. It's designed to, I don't understand how parents don't constantly feel like a failure. And so I wanted to write about this idea of, well, what happens if you create this kind of ideal family and, you know, see if it would fall apart or not.
Well, and those people who write these books have to give you a sense of fear as a motivation to buy their book. I mean, you have to terrify someone to get their attention.
Exactly. And it works. I mean, we've read so many books about how to raise your child, and a lot of them have conflicting information. So then you just do the best you can, and you can't help but feel like on some level you're failing them.
Well, we're going to fail. That's just right. The point.
But you want to believe that there's something you can do that will keep that from happening.
Well, and then in your situation, you've got two kids, and they're not going to be the same temperamentally. So one approach is going to work with one while it's not going to work with the other.
Right. That's been really troubling when I realized that the younger child was not exactly the same as the first. We had to completely relearn how to be a parent, and I was very upset about this.
Well, hopefully you haven't blamed them for that.
No, never blame them. I always blame myself.
Now, the book actually opens up with a brief chapter several years into the project, and it's just as the children are going to start sleeping at their parents' houses.
Right. Yeah, it's a kind of reunion where the children learn for the first time who their true biological parents are. And the hope is that after enough time has passed, they can know this because eventually they'll go out into the world with their true biological parents. But it's a moment of great concern for the parents that, is this going to work? Is the child going to believe that you're their true parent?
Now, in writing about how the kids respond to all the situation, did you actually base it on your research that you had done yourself?
No, I do so little research when I write. I try to do the least amount of research necessary to write whatever book I'm trying to write. And so I looked at psychological studies of child rearing, and, you know, in the end, I was just like, I'm going to push beyond some of the things that I've read and see what I come up with. So the book is the product of how I imagine it would work, not what anyone has told me would happen.
So why did the communal idea strike with you, and that's the one you wanted to run with?
Well, my wife and I one time were talking about the difficulty of raising children, and she's much more calm about everything. She's pretty ace parent. But I said at one point in frustration, I said, I just wish that we could send our kids to this place and they would be raised until they were like 15, and then they'd come back to us and we'd be set and ready to be with them. And Leanne said, well, what would we do while they were away at some scientific experiment? And I said, well, we could live with them. We could live with them while it's happening. And Leanne said, that's a terrible idea. And I said, well, I'm going to find out if it is or isn't. And that's when I started writing the book.
Well, terrible ideas make great books.
Yeah, they're better in books than they are in real life, yeah.
Well, and also, you got to see them grow up when they're small, because when they become teenagers and horrible human beings, you got to remember those cute little faces to keep you from killing them.
It does help. It does help to remember the kind of wildness and innocence of them when they're young, so that as they start to shift, for whatever reason, I can still immediately transport my son back to when he was a small child and see them as clearly as possible in those moments.
Now, I remember you've talked about your father, who's just such a sanguine, happy, happy person,
yes.
Finds the good in almost every situation.
That's right.
And so are you just a reaction that it's kind of like the elder grinds? There wasn't enough friction there for you when you were growing up, and
you had to fill the
void?
I think, you know, my dad is one of those people. We were sitting in the car once, and he said, you know, every day I get up and I go to work and I'm happy. And I just thought, I don't know what this is. I don't know what that means. But it's true. He really is genuinely happy. For whatever reasons, I don't have that same feeling. And what I hope is that, in a lot of ways, in my parenting, I'm trying to step back as much as possible to allow the kids not to be affected by my own nervousness and anxiety.
So what do you feel when you sit down to write?
Writing for me is where I feel a calmness. I wouldn't say it's happiness, because I'm happy in the real world, but I'm always anxious in the real world. And when I write, this kind of creeping easiness comes over me where I feel calm. I'm in control of the world. And even if I don't know exactly what I'm doing, I know that whatever I choose is going to be the thing that happens. And I think that's why I'm a writer, is because the real world is so scary to me, but the imaginary world is a place where I have some manner of control.
The reader's entree into this world, and most of the book is about Izzy Poole, a young woman. She's finishing up high school. She's the youngest and the only single parent in the project.
Right. So she's the kind of outlier in everything. She's a young single mother entirely on her own. She has no familial support. And she was the character. And it's interesting because I've seen a lot of reviews mostly talk about Dr. Grind. I think he's the kind of easy hook. But for me, in starting the story, it was always Izzy. I had this idea of a teenaged woman who was pregnant with a baby, and that's all I could see. And I just had that in my mind for probably a year, and I just kept working it through of who is she, what's she going to do, how is the world going to work for her. And I just kept building this world around this singular character until I had the novel.
She's extremely bright high school student, but she has no desire to go to college.
Right. In some ways, I wasn't extremely bright, but I did well in school, but I never really thought about going to college. It wasn't something that I considered. I just imagined that I would live with my parents forever and they would kind of take care of me. I think sometimes when you have a kind of limited worldview, you don't know what stepping out into the larger world and going to college can do for you, what it can open up. And so it took me a while before I thought, oh, this might be something I'd like to do. And so I could understand Izzy's that even when you're intelligent and even when you're curious, the idea of continuing, of moving on into college is weird. It seems unnecessary.
She lives in a small town near Chattanooga,
yeah,
and lost her mother a couple of years before. And so she's in the small town, doesn't have a maternal figure in her life. So she really has no one modeling any kind of good behavior for her.
Right. And her mother, before she died, wanted Izzy to be exceptional. She taught her how to speed read. She wanted her to leave behind the kind of life that she had been living. And so once her mother dies, she feels completely adrift. There's nobody any longer who cares whether she does well or not.
Her father's there, but he's not.
He's not really a good presence. Yeah, he's kind of out of it. And so it's not until this project comes about that she finds out that there's possibilities for her to go beyond this.
But one of the traps she fell into was falling in love with the art teacher at the high school.
It's that common problem of falling in love with the high school art teacher.
I had a nickel.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, it's this idea that there's this person who speaks to a larger experience, and so she latches onto it in the hopes that maybe there's something better for her. And of course, that doesn't really come to fruition. And now she's even worse off than she was before she started because she's pregnant. And I think about this a lot, especially since we have our two kids. And my wife and I, just raising a child with two people, it's crazy making. And I think about my grandmother who raised my mom as a single mother. I think, how does anything in the world become your own? It's all in service of your child. And so I think about that a lot, of how difficult that must be. And so I wanted to write about a character kind of facing that possibility.
Her art teacher boyfriend is Hal Jackson, and he has had every advantage that she doesn't have.
Right.
Comes from a rich family, had a trust fund to prop him up, and so he's been basically allowed to live the life he's wanted to lead.
Right, right. And I think that's, for Izzy, it's the reason that he's so attractive is because he's alien. He has everything, and she wants to know kind of what that would feel like and what it would be like. And even though Hal has all those things, he's not a particularly happy person. He still feels like a failure. And so once he disappears, Izzy kind of is now left without even that possibility of being connected to a trust fund or an esteemed family.
Now she's pregnant, needs a job, and she gets a job at a barbecue place.
Right.
And she's made a very rare jump in the world of barbecue, a woman working in the pit.
Right. Yeah, she works with her kind of barbecue mentor to do whole hog barbecue. And I think we've talked about it before, but I'm obsessed with barbecue. And so when I thought about this character, I was like, what would be interesting about her? And I was like, oh, she's a woman and she smokes barbecue. It seemed like a good place to go with it. I think there would be something for that character, too, where if the world around you is so unpleasant, there's this kind of miracle of taking this meat, and through the assertion of time and heat and smoke, you get this kind of miracle food. I could see how Izzy would be attracted to that.
So why the particular choice to have Mr. Tannehill work with whole hog barbecue?
I just really like whole hog barbecue. It seems like a pretty interesting cooking method, like in terms of the weight and heft of it. It's a different kind of smoking. And it felt like that seemed more like East Tennessee. It seemed close to North Carolina, where you would see a lot of that. So it just made sense. Plus, I just love the idea, which I, you know, and I've seen in videos and stuff, of the kind of taking of the whole hog and transforming it into a pulled pork is really hypnotic. And so I kind of wanted Izzy to have that experience.
Well, I don't like in the whole hog how they chop up the pork.
It's one of those things, like in the same way that, like, I'm a pretty open reader. Like, I pretty much love everything I read. I'm not a good critic. I love every kind of barbecue I've ever eaten. There is no kind of barbecue that I dislike. There's just forms that I like better.
Well, which form do you like the best?
I like whole hog with a vinegar-based sauce, something simple. maybe on a bun, but otherwise I like pork better than anything, and I generally like it with a vinegar sauce. But I say that, but then when I come to Memphis and I eat ribs, I'm like, how could anyone eat anything other than ribs? So I guess it depends on where I am.
Well, I'm weird. I like the South Carolina mustard sauce.
Oh, wow. Yeah. We have family in South Carolina, and every time I eat it, I'm like, this is the strangest thing.
But I love it so much.
It's good.
But so many, especially over into the Georgia side, right across from South Carolina, they chop up the meat so fine. It's almost like it's already been chewed for you, and I don't understand why they do that. And then that rice hash they like to serve
yes.
with everything.
Yeah. Oh, I dig that, actually. Yeah.
Also, we find out that if it hadn't been for Hal's involvement in her life, not only getting pregnant with her, that she wouldn't have been considered for the Infinite Family Project in the first place.
That's right. Yeah. So it's Hal's family kind of wanting to avoid embarrassment, hook her up with this project. And it seemed fitting that Hal, who was kind of useless in a lot of ways, could at least give her this possibility of a happier life without him. And so she's able to find her way into the project through Hal's parents.
And so what's her first approach like into dealing with Dr. Grind, and what are her feelings when she's considering this?
Well, I think it seems so foreign to her that it's hard to believe that it's real. And Dr. Grind himself is such a kind of oddly calm and quiet person that she thinks there must be some ulterior motive or something that she's not getting. But in the end, I think there's this idea that you push yourself into uncomfortable spaces in the service of the people that you're taking care of. And so for Izzy, no matter how scary the possibility is, what she has isn't great. So she can push herself into that space if it means a better life for her kid.
The Infinite Family Project is made possible not through government studies and regular grants from foundations, but a singular vision
yes.
from a donor named Brenda Acklin. And she's the benefactor, and her family has this retail empire. And they seem kind of like a cross between the Waltons from Walmart and maybe the Haslams of Tennessee, who have the truck stop empire.
Yes, that's very nice. Yeah, I thought a lot about the Waltons, and I just thought if I had that much money, I would put it in service of crazy things. I just know that I would. I know that I wouldn't use it responsibly. And
okay, top three projects.
I think I would set up the Infinite Family Project. That's the main thing I would want. But I thought also about the Waltons and the kind of art museum that they have in Arkansas.
Crystal
like
Bridges.
These in service of these things that perhaps you wouldn't expect. And so I knew that this was a project that seemed weird enough that it couldn't be government funded. It would need to be an eccentric billionaire. So I made up an eccentric billionaire.
Now, Brenda Acklin has a personal stake in this. She has her own history with unstable families as well.
Right, right. So her mother gave her up to an orphanage when she was young. And it's one of those things where she lived with this kind of communal family, although artificial. But for her, she imagines those days as the best times of her life. And she wonders if in some ways it was because her mother, who was incapable of taking care of her, puts her in this place where she's surrounded by people that she thinks of as a kind of makeshift family. And so I think in her mind, she wants to put money forward to kind of recreate that experience, but in a way that children get every advantage possible. So yeah, she has this personal history. And that was when I was telling Ann Patchett, my friend, about the book, I said, I'm thinking about this weird project. And she mentioned orphanages in the 30s and 40s where people weren't orphaned, they were just dropped off. And sometimes they would be picked back up until the money ran out and then dropped off again. And she was like, you need to figure out how to put that in the book. And I thought, oh, that'll be Miss Acklin's story then.
Well, had you heard about the West Tennessee?
Only afterwards.
Oh, but yes, afterwards,
yeah.
Because Ric Flair, the professional wrestler, was adopted out of the West.
Are you serious?
Yes.
Oh, my God. That's incredible. Well, now I have a lot of reading to do.
So now we have three major parts of the story. Brenda Acklin with her mother abandoning her. Preston Grind, his parents dying when he was very young after growing out of the constant friction
right.
method. And Izzy losing her mother and her father not being around.
Right.
We have three people who have lost parents in significant ways that are at the heart of the story.
Right, right. It is this sense of these people who have lost something essential seeking to recreate their idea of a perfect family. This project gives them the opportunity to see what would happen, kind of their wildest dream. And you're right that it's these three characters that are kind of the forward momentum of the book hinges on these three characters. There are others, you know, there are other families in the project, but their narrative isn't quite as closely aligned as these three characters.
So there are nine other children involved with their parents. How do you go about creating an ideal lineup for who you populate your story with?
Very poorly, I think. You know, it was one of the things when I started writing this, I was like, the project needs to be big enough that there's enough people to form a kind of communal experience. And I was like, God, you got to create all those characters. And I knew that the focal point of the narrative was Dr. Grind and Izzy. And so it's this weird balancing act where you want to give enough information about these other families because their children are essentially Izzy's, her children too, but you can't give them so much space and time in the book or else the book becomes 1,000 pages and you've lost the kind of forward momentum. So that was hard. And yet for the book's sake, it was pretty easy to figure out that when Dr. Grind's putting this together, he thinks, I want people that are need-based, but also we want it to be diverse. We want to get a group of people that necessarily wouldn't live together given their first choice. So it's diverse in terms of region, in terms of race, as much as it can be, just to see, again, to kind of give it this feeling of if we put all these various people into one space, they will, of course, happily live together in harmony.
And this is very ambitious. It's a 10-year project.
Right.
And so even assuming that the parents of these children can remain romantic couples for 10 years, considering how high the divorce rate is in America, is wildly optimistic as it is.
Right. Yeah. There's nothing about it that suggests that it should work because I live in a very small town and I see a lot of people all the time. And I think there's something about the closeness of connection that can make for really strong relationships, but it can also create an intense kind of mania of being so closely surrounded by other people and feeling like you're never alone. So I think Dr. Grind has these optimistic ideas. If you can apply science to something, it will work out. And I think Izzy is more pragmatic. I think she realizes that she's just going to try and get whatever she can get out of it before the thing blows up.
And I would assume part of his thinking is that in raising a child can be very difficult and induce a lot of stress into a relationship. And this would hopefully alleviate some of that. And make
it more. Right. That if you're the sole person responsible for a child, the stress is greater than if you have 19 or so other people or 18 other people helping you. And not just that, but like research assistants, all these other people whose kind of primary task is to make sure that your children are taken care of. It can take some of the burden off of you and in some ways allow you to kind of pursue the things that you genuinely care about.
So with all this basis in science and research setting up, how do you keep track of the humanity of your characters in all this?
Yeah, it's hard because it's hard not to think of them as simply subjects in a test. And the way that I tried to deal with it as a writer was I just tried to understand that even in this hope for perfection, these characters are going to be flawed. And in some ways, no matter how perfect the circumstances are, those flaws are going to create friction. And in some ways, for me, what's most reassuring about the world is how universal the idea is that we're all flawed in some way, that there's no real perfection possible. And so for me, watching the project start to fall apart was actually the most rewarding part of it in some ways. It gave me some reassurance that even no matter what our best intentions are, there are going to be these things that complicate it. And the real kind of goal of life is to figure out how to live within those flaws.
Were the science-y bits engineered as to achieve the desired effect, or were they kind of retrofitted back on the back end of it?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think it kind of moved hand in hand at first, and then I realized I needed to perhaps do more with Dr. Grind. Are you talking about like the actual scientific aspects of the book itself?
Right. I mean, did you say, okay, I've set up this experiment this way, let's see how it plays out? Or you have a plot playing out and you got to go, well, what would it induce these?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, no, I think for me it was, let's just see what happens. And that's what a lot of writing for me is that I have a conceit. I'm very conceit-based in terms of creating ideas. I just think, what would happen if this? And then the writing of the book is this kind of instinctual moving towards what I think is correct. And a lot of times it's different than what I immediately suspected would happen. So for this book, it was, let's see what will happen. And then the book itself kind of surprises me as to how I knew on some level it would fall apart, right? It wouldn't be perfect. It wouldn't be a perfect little world. But I was surprised as I continued to write it, just the ways in which that might fall apart.
How do we get these people to have some conflict?
Yeah, exactly. And one of the things that I think about is that I'm not sure that there is a ton of conflict in the book. I know that's not a good thing to say, but for me, it was a weird experiment in that I wanted to write a book where people are changed, but not necessarily that big things happen. That was my kind of goal, where the changes happen in very small increments.
Because it is a strange situation in which people are there with a focus. Mm-hmm. And it's not in our normal lives when we're all have our own agendas going everywhere. In the Infinite Family Project, they all have the same agenda to help their child be raised in such a way as to improve their chances later in life.
Right.
And so everyone is focused on that one thing. So it really does kind of eliminate so many of the frictions that are in the outside world.
Right. Yeah. I think that's true. But I also think that there's a moment in the book where one of the research assistants tells Dr. Grine, you know, like, you're so focused on the children and the children are going to be fine. It's the adults that you have to worry about. And I think that's true, that for adults, there's this idea of, yes, we're working towards this common goal, but wouldn't it also be nice if I had this other thing or something else beyond that? And that's where, of course, the complication is going to come from.
Now, you have a representation of the famous marshmallow test, in which a child is offered a marshmallow or offered two marshmallows if they can wait 15 minutes and not eat the first marshmallow.
Right.
Did you have any research that you based how they would react that on, or that was just another?
It's one of those. It's, again, about my own anxiety as a parent. You know, I've heard about that experiment, and I thought, if my sons were offered a marshmallow, they would eat it in 5 seconds. There is no doubt in my mind that there's no way they would wait 15 minutes in order to get a second one. They would eat it. And I was like, is that a failing on my part? Have I not raised them? But I just think he's a kid and he will eat that marshmallow. And so I wanted to introduce that experiment into the book as a possibility for, no matter how much we want to believe that if we raise our children a certain way, they'll respond a certain way. I wanted to see what would happen if they, you know, for all intents and purposes, perhaps the way you raise them creates the conflict that you were hoping to avoid.
I saw a recent editorial cartoon where they had the president taking the marshmallow test.
Yeah, that's very nice.
So let's talk about AstroTurf.
Okay.
Why is it all over the place at the compound?
So early on when I was writing the book, I was trying to figure out what the structure would look like, what the complex would look like. And I kind of drew up, I'm not artistic in any way, but I kind of drew up an idea of these kind of linked houses. But I started looking online and I found this one series of this architect created this schoolhouse in Spain, I believe it was. And the buildings are these white kind of houses that are all connected, and they had natural vegetation on the roofs so that it kind of blended into the environment. And I really loved it, and it looked beautiful. It looked like something out of a fairy tale. And I just thought that might be difficult to replicate for the Infinite Family Project, but they would seek to do it in an artificial way. They would create AstroTurf to mimic the idea of a natural world. So again, it was this kind of way that, like, it wouldn't be natural, it would be scientific. So they put this AstroTurf to kind of suggest that they are a part of the environment.
Made me think a little bit of Philip K. Dick's Do Androids Dream
of
Electric
yeah.
Sheep? They have the little gardens on top
that's
of that.
That's very nice. That's very nice.
Getting back to a theme that has haunted you most of your life.
Yeah.
I just saw a trailer recently for the Russian science fiction movie Guardians.
Okay.
And it features a man bear with a machine gun.
Are you serious?
I'm serious.
That's incredible.
And if you want to take a quick break and look at the trailer, I want to get your response
okay,
to it.
Okay, I'd love to see it.
Well, Kevin, now that you've seen the trailer, what do you think?
Oh, yeah. I'm 100% in on that movie. It looks incredible. And you're right. I have this strange childlike fascination with this kind of half-human, half-bear creature. And so to see it in this movie is pretty incredible. I'm still trying to figure out how to work that into my own fiction. But that I may not need to anymore now that the definitive half-human, half-bear creature has been formed.
I remember the last time we talked, you were trying to put the bear into a suburban situation where he was drinking bourbon and selling insurance.
Right.
Has there been any other permutations since?
No, I'm still like, I'm always trying to figure out the balance between what's feral and what's human. And it just never quite works out the way I want it to. Maybe it's just something that lives in my head. It's like my spirit animal is a half-human, half-bear creature.
I hate to ask you this question since this is pub date for your book when we're talking. Do you have another idea?
Yeah, I have another idea for a book, and I'm going to start working on it. I'm outlining stuff now, and I'll start working on it this summer. And it's another about weird families and strange children. I can't get away from it. I want to write about the complexities of family until I come up with something better or until I figure it out. That's what I'm going to keep writing about. And the way that it's starting to form in my head now is a return in some ways to magical realism. I feel like maybe that's where I'm going to move now in trying to interpret the complexities of family is to use fabulism.
Have you ever been tempted to write about family for kids?
I'm interested in it, especially now that I'm reading so many books with my own kids, and it's such a delicate thing to do that I'm impressed with the people who can pull it off. I used to think that maybe my work was too melancholy, like too sad or tinged with sadness, but God, there are some beautiful books for kids that are sad as hell that just make me cry. So it's something I could think about. It would be wonderful with all of these books that it was working towards research for something else.
This past holiday season, I watched a bunch of old Christmas specials with my girlfriend's daughter. She's 11. And we hadn't watched the specials in several years. And we watched, God, Santa's a jerk. Everyone's terrible. These things are such bummers. We'd never realized that.
There are so many times I'm reading a book to my son and it makes me weep, and he'll look at me, he's like, what is wrong with you? And I'm like, nothing, it's just, it's very emotional. But for him, it's just something that he's completely invested in.
Well, Kevin, I want to thank you so much for stopping back by today. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh God, I love it. Thanks so much.
Kevin Wilson is the author of Perfect Little World, which is published by Echo HarperCollins. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.